Welcome back to You Had to Be There, the podcast where we deep dive into the crowds of concerts, festivals, the music industry, and more. I'm your host, Julia Gomberg. This week, I'm thrilled to have not just one of the industry's best, but also a dear friend and former colleague of mine, Alyssa Byrne. Alyssa's a pro's pro when it comes to music publishing and rights management. In fact, she's the senior publisher relations manager at TuneCore, a powerhouse in the independent music distribution scene. We talk about all things publishing, but also deep dive into her love for metal, pop punk, and emo music. So be sure to also check out her You Had to Be There curated playlist for the podcast, which you can find on our Instagram at the letter U, Had to Be There Pod. Before we dive into the heart of music publishing with Alyssa, let's take a moment to clarify some key terms you might hear during our conversation. Understanding these will help you navigate the intricate world of music publishing, and it will help you know what the hell we're talking about. So TuneCore, where Alyssa works as the senior publisher relations manager, is a key player in the independent music scene. They basically act as a bridge between independent artists, so artists who are not signed to labels, and music stores and streaming platforms, otherwise known as DSPs. So this means like Spotify, Apple Music, and many more. And so TuneCore helps independent musicians get their music distributed to those platforms. Another term you'll definitely hear us say is publishing administration. This refers just to the process of collecting royalties, so payments, whenever a song is played, performed, or reproduced. Another big term we talk about is sync publishing. So this focuses on licensing songs for use in films, TV shows, commercials, and video games and other media. Lastly, collection societies. You'll hear us say that, and Alyssa mentions ASCAP, which stands for the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. So imagine a songwriter writes a song. These collection societies work as basically a collection agency to make sure that the songwriter gets paid whenever their song is used or played, like on the radio or in a movie. These societies also track how often each song is used and distributes the collected royalties to its members based on that usage data. And when we say members, we mean there could be payments going to not just the performer, but there could be songwriters, there could be producers. It gets a little murky, but that's basically the gist. Now that you're prepped with some of the key music industry terms you'll hear, you're basically a pro. So let's dive into this episode and learn even more from Alyssa. Thanks for listening.
Hello, my name is Alyssa Byrne. I am the senior manager of writer and publisher relations at TuneCore, the longest title to exist. I'm based in LA. I'm an Aries. Yeah, that's me. I love music.
Amazing. A fiery music fan and professional. We love to hear it.
Yes.
Awesome. And how long have you been at TuneCore for?
The end of June will be 5 years. You believe that?
That is insane.
I know. It feels insane. It feels equally short and long.
Yeah. Well, so for those who don't know, I worked with Alyssa five years ago.
Yeah.
Insane. When we were on the same team, you were doing a different role. What was that role?
Ooh, what a journey. So I started out on the marketing team at TuneCore with Julia, and I was in the sales role for like 6 months.
Right.
And that was like a trial that we were running. That was a test that we got results from, but I don't think they were necessarily the results they were looking for. So I got transitioned to international marketing specialist. And at the time, TuneCore is very global now. I think we are in 30 plus countries. But at the time, I think we were in 4. Wow. So it was easier for someone on the entry level side to manage 4 countries as opposed to 30 and that strategy.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I couldn't forgot about the sales component.
Oh, like, yeah.
Totally left my mind. Wow. What a journey it has been for you. Okay. And I realized, like, for those who have no idea what the hell TuneCore is, can you explain what TuneCore is? Yeah. I was like, wait.
Yeah. So TuneCore is a independent artist development platform, formerly really just focused on distribution, but nowadays really kind of trying to be a one-stop shop for independent artists to have as many resources at their disposal to support themselves. So going a little deeper on that, like, I'm on the publishing side, And a lot of the time people think either distribution and publishing are the same thing, that they cannot coexist. Like, people have a lot of thoughts about how those things, you know, intertwine. But TuneCore does a whole lot of things. One is distribution. That's what they're primarily known for. Publishing, which is what I focus on. And then we have some other things like YouTube monetization, creator tools. You know, we have relationships with the DSPs, so playlisting options, sync licensing under publishing again. So there's a whole lot of things that TuneCore does these days.
It's crazy. It really is a one-stop shop for an artist, which is awesome. Yeah. So for someone maybe who doesn't understand like a label versus being independent, what like makes staying independent valuable for an artist in like the music industry?
Yeah, I think the big thing that people talk about is creative control. So I think there's almost a tendency to like vilify the labels these days, which I find interesting, because I think coming up and, you know, being younger, I'm 30 now, but, you know, coming up and figuring out who I wanted to be in this industry, you know, I was like, fuck the labels, like they're terrible people. But that's really not, it's not true. I think the difference primarily, like I said, people really talk about creative control and making sure that as an artist, being independent means that you're able to say, okay, this is when I want my release to go out. This is what I want to sound like, look like. This is where I want to tour. Like, you have a lot of that sort of control over your own career. But what comes at, you know, the other side of that is you don't have money necessarily. So a label, a label can give you a cash injection, a label, you know, and a lot of the time now, like in 2023, 2024, the label deals, I feel like, are a little bit more flexible than they ever have been. And, you know, people aren't necessarily signing out 100% of their rights anymore, or, you know, giving out anything that feels unfair. In some cases, obviously that still exists some places, but, yeah, I think the big difference is, do you want to have creative control or do you want to have somebody back you financially? And there are ways as an independent artist to sign, you know, distribution only deals where you sign with a company who's only going to handle distribution for you and give you an advance for that. Or you sign with a marketing and a PR firm and they're helping you kind of boost things and see your value, your potential, and want to help you out that way. And you sign the contract with them. So I think there's ways now that there weren't before that independent artists are able to like be afforded the same advantages of being on a label without the commitment and loss of creative control that comes with that.
Totally. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Do you think like the whole thing that happened with Scooter Braun and Taylor Swift, do you think that like impacted sort of the change of like people wanting more control or?
No, it's a good question. I think that because it was so public, you know, Taylor Swift obviously is like bigger than God these days. So she's got a microphone. She knows how to use it. Her bringing to light some of the kind of historical standards, I guess, of like how this works and what an artist and a songwriter are entitled to, because a lot of the time you get treated very differently if you're a songwriter as opposed to an artist. She's both, so she sees both sides of the coin. But I mean, I think that it definitely brings to light some of those issues in a really powerful way, and I commend her for that. And I think that with like I'm not gonna give her all the credit though. Like, I think social media is real powerful. People are more educated than ever. They're more tapped in. They're, you know, even artists that are well established are learning things and then like cascading that out to their audience who are, you know, aspiring musicians. But I think there's way more information readily available and people have more at their, you know, more resource at their disposal. There was also, just speaking of like things like that, Kanye posting his contract with Universal and talking about how his publishing deal was like fucked up or whatever. Like, there are things that happen like this all the time in the media. I think Taylor Swift is just who she is, and that's why she gets the
attention. That's why she got the clout.
But yeah, no, I think it's definitely part of it. And I think that awareness is just like way more widespread. Like, I went to go see an artist perform. I think she just came off of a Sony deal. And I have a friend who works in casting, so she was like, you know, trying to be an actress also. So we went to go see the show. And I like, it was the first time, and I remember being really like taken aback by this. She on stage was like, I'm an independent artist. And I was like, that's such an interesting like thing in the like zeitgeist of the music industry right now to flex. Like, I think that that would be something that you would never hear, you know, a few years ago, that someone would be like, very, especially coming right off of a deal, you know, being like super gung-ho, super excited about it, like kind of in this like in your face energy. And of course we know like the independent music scene has been thriving forever, and I don't mean to discredit that in any way, but for someone in that kind of mainstream space to be so fuck the label.
Yeah, you don't hear that. Yeah, you don't see that very much, but it's cool that she kind of made it empowering as opposed to like controversial or whatever, because it's it is
important. Yeah, and it's almost like this badge of honor these days that you can do it yourself and like you don't have to be at the mercy of someone controlling your career, which is cool.
It is cool. I mean, that's always why I loved TuneCore, and like I think it's such a good resource also to like learn so much of what you're talking about. Like I still use TuneCore just to like brush on my like like the website's so helpful.
Like seriously, like, you care about this stuff. You know what I mean? I think that's what makes the difference, is that we really, really give a shit. And the people who are writing these resources like have the best interests of artists and songwriters in mind, and like we're really focused on that earnestly. Totally. Like it's not for any, like I'm not making a commission on anything, you know what I mean? Like I really just genuinely care about this stuff. And I think like backpedaling to what I was saying TuneCore does, I think the educational piece is huge, and it's something that we've leaned into and put a lot of money behind, and you know, a lot of investment, and for a good reason.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really cool to see it like evolve, and your part in that. So on the side that you're in, music publishing, to someone who's maybe never heard of it or like has heard of it.
So the whole world.
So the whole world. I didn't want to say that, but yes.
Nobody knows what publishing is. It's an enigma. Honestly, like I've said this so many times, like I should have a count on my desk, like one of those little machines that's just like a clicker. But every call I have with artists, like, you know, who are coming to me being like, I don't know what this is, I say to them, publishing is complicated on purpose. And the purpose is to ask you out of your own money. So,
that's a good one.
Yeah. So and I think that like companies like, you know, TuneCore, Centric, like there are some companies out there that are really songwriter friendly and like have a lot of this educational content, and have folks like, you know, myself or, you know, anybody else who's doing the talks and the 101 sessions and the webinars to like really spread the word and like get things going out there for publishing. So it's a really powerful aspect of the industry. It's the royalties that come from the commercial use of written songs. So what I mean by that is, and maybe a simple way to understand it, distribution is to the sound recording as publishing is to the composition. So when you create a song, you're effectively creating two assets that collect different royalties. One is the material itself, and the other is the recording of that material. And they're commercially kind of used together, but then paid separately. So publishing is concerned with the composition. The money that you're getting from your distributor, if it's TuneCore, if it's CD Baby, DistroKid, you know, all of those, those royalties come from your sound recording. Anything from publishing is coming from the written material.
Is that what mechanical and performance royalties are? Is that something different?
Yeah. So publishing is, exactly. So like a lot of the time people will kind of throw those terms around and you know, there are, you could argue that you could call a sound recording royalty a performance royalty, but with publishing specifically, you have performance royalties, mechanical royalties, micro sync. So like things that come from TikTok, YouTube, AV use, like user generated content. And, you know, print. So things that are like sheet music, lyrics online. So that's generating royalties for you. And then sync. So like getting your music into TV shows, movies, commercials, which generate two kinds of funds. Most of the time, sometimes, you have your fee, which is like an upfront cost that the production company is paying you for using your song. And then there might be some royalties that come from the performance of that project. So if you get, you know, if your TV show, say Insecure, we've done a couple of placements with Insecure, Issa Rae's show, who I'm such a fan of. If that gets, I don't know, 10 million plays on HBO, like there's a certain royalty rate that's associated with that stream of that show. So like, depending on your contract and the agreement therein, like that can be a factor or not. But so those are the kind of primary royalties that you're dealing with and payments that you're dealing with publishing.
That makes sense. Yes, there's a podcast I listen to called How Long Gone, and whenever they interview bands and artists, they have this segment called Sync Talk, and they like ask the band what their most expensive sync, like I guess partnership or agreement is,
and it's what a question. Just,
like, so funny because some people are like, nah, like I don't do that, like I'm staying, like I'm anti-commercial, and then other people are like, yeah man, we got like a huge deal from like a Ford commercial or something.
Hell yeah.
And it's just interesting, like there's almost like I'm surprised that there's some almost a stigma from some of them about it, because I'm like, no, get that bag.
Exactly. And that's, you know, you don't have to, unless like you're hardcore fans or like looking out for this Ford commercial, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
Most of the time people aren't going to know what the song is. You know what I mean? So like, you can, yeah, you know, especially in a commercial, like an ad. But yeah, no, I would say to anyone who is hesitant about getting their music into sync, there are a lot of different ways to approach sync. With TuneCore, you know, we pitch things, we react to music supervisors who we've built our network with. And, you know, if they request a certain kind of sound, or you know, a song that sounds like Cardi B, or you know, whatever, we're able to respond to those briefs with similar music that we manage. But if you're an independent songwriter, then and musician, like you can decide how you want to pitch for sync. You can work with a sync agent, you can work with a publisher, you can pitch yourself. Like, there are a lot of different ways to play it. And the reason I'm saying all this is because I want to illustrate the point that like you can say no to things. Like, if you are the kind of person who doesn't want to support big auto or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, you can say, I'm not going to let a car company use my song, but maybe you'll license your work to, I don't know, national park commercial or something. Right. Like, you can in some instances cherry pick the kinds of projects that you want your music in. And I think that's something to keep in mind if you are hesitant to get that bag. Because, hello, go get your money.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's your money. It's your song. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And then it's interesting what you mentioned. What was it called? Mini sync?
Microsync.
Microsync. That is that relatively new because of like social media changing.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, relatively speaking. I mean, like, I think that's kind of a colloquial reference like to it. You could call that like both performance and mechanical also, but the royalties themselves that come from the reproduction of the composition on social media. So like Reels, TikTok, YouTube, a lot of like the UGC content. And that's also just like as a quick little pro tip. A lot of people think that the royalties that come from TikTok are from the views on your videos. That's not true. The royalties that get generated come from video creations that use your content.
Oh, you heard it here
first. Just a little pro tip. Yeah.
So like if let's say you see a cool video of like a cool song and then you use that audio in a video you make, that's how they would earn.
Exactly.
Nice. Okay. That's good to know. I mean, not that I do it, but just in case other people do.
Dude, I post on social media twice a year, so.
I know. I was doing some stalking. I found a TikTok you were in and they asked you your road trip song, I think.
God, what are you talking about?
I was just trying to like find tidbits of things like you've talked about, and that like was the first thing to pop up, and it was
what
like,
I say.
You said it was when you were in Switzerland, I think. Is that, and you were like the 18 song, like Upside Down? Is that what it's called?
Oh, holy shit!
I was not expecting you to
say that. I fucking love that song. No, I'm not gonna lie.
No, it's a good road trip song. I was like, oh, damn, right.
Yeah, which like contextually just. For anyone listening, like I'm a metal girl, so like that's why that's a departure.
Yes, and which we'll definitely get into. But yeah, that's, I was like, wait. And it's also funny that you don't even remember that.
I don't. I truly don't.
It just proves your point that you're not on social media much.
So. I'm so not. It's horrible.
No, I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing. But okay, cool. And then for sync, like that things you've worked on, are there any standout sync deals that you got to like be involved in that stand out for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question for me specifically because I do no more than confirm the right to license. Mm. So like I'm not the person who is picking and choosing music. That's like more what a music supervisor does. So somebody who's working on, you know, the commercial side, so, or the TV right. side, they will come to us and say, do you have something that sounds like X? And right. we look through our like Rolodex, so to speak. And we use Disco, who I absolutely love. The team there is so nice and the product is incredible. And I'm a big Disco fan.
Awesome.
Yeah. And they are kind of the industry standard, I would say, for moving music around to music supervisors. So like, mm-hmm. again, any artists, independent, you know, managers, whoever, have Disco on your radar as a means of communicating with music supervisors to float your music.
That's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we have, I want to say, I don't know how many it is, but it's thousands of songs, in Disco, like ready to go. Their rights are cleared. We're, you know, understanding of what their splits picture is and who's going to get paid what percentage and all of that. So like, right. that's kind of my lane. I don't do a lot of curating per se, although I will say outside of TuneCore, I have a few friends who work in film because in LA, you can't not have friends who work in entertainment. I would love to do some music supervision for them. So if you're listening, friends.
Yes. Yes. But I think that's such a cool job. That was always my dream job growing up, like being the person
you
to choose. But don't you have to have a legal background?
No.
No?
No. You can do whatever you want.
I guess that's fair. Maybe I was just making an excuse. I just like remember the way that I first heard about like Sync and all of that was just like from watching The OC, because the
music
supervisor on that show is like one of my like favorite females in the industry. And
so good.
And like that was such a pivotal time when like social media didn't even exist, and that was like such a popular show, and how so many bands got big at that time, obviously. And like,
yeah,
I just remember like, whoa, this is so cool, and like such an organic way for, you know, artists to be discovered.
Absolutely. Especially at that time. Also, like, shout out One Tree Hill. I feel like,
yes, in terms same of vibe.
Yeah, same vibe, almost leans a little darker, which I loved. And I only say this now because I just watched One Tree Hill for the first time last year, and it was
nice.
Chef's kiss. Incredible.
I did that a few years ago too. It's such a good show to like watch in its entirety.
Yeah.
Especially just that era of music is so nostalgic.
Oh, it's so close to my heart. It's like it's my favorite one. Like I grew up, you know, go to Warped Tour every summer and stuff. So like any of those sort of they're not metal, but they're like fringe emo, I guess you could say, post hardcore, blah blah blah. They're 1500 mini genres.
Yeah, even like, in my notes, I didn't know how to specify your taste in music. I literally have like five different genres for each question.
Because that's how many. They're like I couldn't even confidently say like what I like if I had to go on Jeopardy and be like what kind of whatever, I'd be like, oh, I'm panicking.
Okay, that makes me feel better. Yeah, because I wrote down like emo, pop punk, hardcore, post hardcore,
all of that. Yeah. Love it all.
Love it. Well, okay, awesome. I'm excited to get into that. I just have a couple other career questions.
Yeah.
So what's the point of people, you know, claiming their music or claiming their royalties? Why? What's the point? This obviously to get the bag, like we said, but like
you're getting at a good point, because like that it seems like a simple thing, but there are a lot of layers to it. So if you like a very common thing that I hear from our clients or, you know, people I meet out, you know, conferences, whatever, I have BMI, I'm good. Like I get my publishing royalties, and that's just simply not the case. There are, like we talked about, there's royalties that come from your sound recording, and then there's royalties that come from your composition. A PRO, right? So for BMI is a PRO in the United States, like ASCAP, like GMR, CSAC, like all of these different organizations, their job is to collect performance royalties.
Right.
And we already talked about there's mechanical royalties, there's microcent, there's all of these different kinds of things, right?
Like, right.
So it's really important for songwriters to understand that BMI is a great first step, and it's so important to have a PRO. But if you don't have a way and a means of collecting those other funds, you're missing out on what could be like 75% of your publishing revenue.
Wow.
The other thing to consider, and it's this is why I said it's an interesting kind of point you're getting at, because it's more than just getting paid. If you don't have songs registered, music supervisors can't find you. So, like, good luck getting a sync.
Right.
So this is why, like, publishing and sync are so close, because there's a lot of, like, it is licensing, right? So the same way that you would license or, you know, trademark or whatever, like a toy or, you know, Mattel, Barbie, like anything like that, you have to license the material you're using in order to use it. But if you can't effectively prove the owner of whatever that content is or understand, you know, who owns that content, you can't license it. So having your songs registered with your PRO, making sure that everything is registered everywhere so that you're collecting everything you can is, yes, important for financial reasons. But it's also important to not ask yourself out of opportunities.
And like you said, there's such a high percentage of the revenue that's not getting claimed. So what happens with that if for those people who don't know about it?
Yeah, that's a great question. Also, like, I'm such a stan of the MLC. It's the Mechanical Licensing Collective is responsible for digital U.S. mechanical royalties. And Dave Bogan, who started the DERP initiative, which is a very funny acronym for, it's like Distributor Unmatched Royalties Portal, I believe. But he just won an award at Music Biz this week for his like, contribution to innovation, you know, in cataloging this like metadata so that artists can get paid. Just as like a buzz stat, I think when the MLC formed back in, I think they started in 2018, started like fully functioning as a business in 2020, don't quote me, $424 million of unclaimed revenue was identified initially. I heard Chris Aaron, who's their CEO, speak on a panel at a conference here in LA in October. And at that time, he said they had paid out $1.7 billion with a B to artists.
Whoa.
So
that is a lot.
Yeah. And like, there is this, like, people talk about the black box. There is this sort of like unclaimed pool of revenue that just sits if you don't effectively claim it. And what I mean by effectively is you're registered at BMI, you're registered with the MLC, or you have a publishing administrator who's doing this for you, i.e. TuneCore comes on out. But if that's not happening, your part, all some of your funds are being held basically in escrow until someone does something with them. And at a certain point, these companies that are responsible for collecting this revenue have to kind of offload it. And the way that that gets done is it gets liquidated via market share. So like if Sony and Universal and Warner own 90% of the market, 90% of that money is going to them. Bet your bottom dollar it doesn't get its way to the artists that well.
Damn, artists, get on it.
Yeah, it's bullshit. And I'll say that with my chest to anybody.
Yeah. No, I mean, I love just hearing like... From obviously like when we worked together, you had just started this kind of side of the industry, and it's so cool to hear your knowledge and like passion about it.
Thank you.
You're explaining it so well. Yeah, no, totally. And I know like you do a lot of different panels and stuff. I can absolutely see why you're explaining it in a very like easy way to understand, at least for me.
Cool.
That's awesome. And I guess also you mentioned in the beginning, like when you were doing international, you know, TuneCore worked with about 5 countries and now it's expanded so much. And I know you've gotten to travel a lot. So like, what has that been like and what do you do in terms of the international side?
Well, internationally, I would love to travel more to TuneCore, but yes. I've done a lot of like Nashville, Austin, Atlanta, like that kind of stuff. But, I did get a chance to go to Liverpool, who, Centric Music is our publishing partner. They have been since 2018. Fun fact, Believe, who owns TuneCore, just acquired Centric last year. So now everything is very much.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. So Believe, again, just for anybody listening who is not familiar, Believe is a artist services company based in France, and they own several different companies. TuneCore is one of them. Nuclear Blast, which is the biggest metal label in the world. I'm a huge fan of them. So yeah, so those businesses, and now Centric is under the umbrella as well, which makes our day-to-day honestly not that different, but there's a little bit less red tape, a little bit less, you know, politicking of, you know, how you sort through things and whatever, everything's kind of under the same roof, which is nice. So I got a chance to go to Liverpool a couple years back and spend some time with their team face-to-face, because this, like the rights team that sits in Liverpool on the Centric side are basically like the back of house of what we do. So like the analogy I like to use whenever anybody asks about that relationship is I say, if you've ever worked at a restaurant you know, you have your front of house staff and your back of house staff. So you have your front of house, which is like your, you know, your host, your wait staff, your manager, like
right.
people who are customer facing, basically, right? Like your diners
right.
facing. And then you have your cooks and your dishwashers and the people who make the things run. So Centric and the rights team, they're kind of, you know, there's this dedicated rights team and they are concerned only with TuneCore's catalog. So mm-hmm. they are our back of house and then we serve as kind of the front of house is how I like to think about it.
Yeah.
So I interact with them a ton. You know, we're on calls multiple times a week, emails back and forth every single day. And you know, just to get that FaceTime with them was really, really nice. I also went to the Beatles Museum in Liverpool and like, it was cool. Hot take. I'm not a huge fan. They're really cool. They've done cool shit for the industry. Like whatever. I don't love the music. It is what it is. But,
I was going to say, oh my God, Liverpool, are you a huge Beatles fan? Never mind.
Like, no, I think they're fine. Like, I always get like the like guffaw at it. But I'm like, honestly, bro, more of a Stones girl.
okay, there it is. Yeah. Hot take for sure, but I like it. I'll respect it. As a huge Beatles fan, I'll respect it.
Yeah, and like nothing but respect. Like I think they're great. It's just yes. not my taste. So it was really cool to see the history and like the museum there and stuff and kind of be in the city and the energy there was great. The people are amazing. The food, incredible. Didn't see that coming.
Really?
Yeah.
That is a plot twist. Oh my
God. Oh my God. I could do like a whole restaurant list for you. It's yeah, it was amazing. But yeah, it's just, it's a really kind of grassroots city and like the people are so cool and nice. And you know, the team at Centric is an absolute dream.
It just sounds really cohesive now, which is awesome. I think that's like yeah. such an important factor of like being successful as a team and like having that as, yeah, it seems really collaborative. So that's really cool.
Yeah.
I'm looking through my notes. I feel like we covered everything pretty well. Is there anything else in your role that you're really passionate about, maybe that I didn't mention that's worth talking about? And you can totally say
but no, I hate it. No, I think we covered a lot. I think the one thing that is like a tricky one for me with sync is I think that a lot of the time people think like, oh, I have publishing covered. I'm going to get a sync now. And I like to just kind of temper expectations right. for people and say like you have to be so focused on it. And like, even if you are, the chances of you getting a sync are not that high. And I think it's something where
right.
unless you are like very, again, focused, making the connections, like writing stuff specifically for sync, and that's kind of your lane. That is not what like a mainstream artist does. You know what I mean? So it's a different strategy entirely. It would be like, you know, you have like composers who write for film and then you have Sabrina Carpenter and those people do different things. Right. So like for sync,
right.
you know, I would just kind of take it with a grain of salt, like, you know, best practices. A lot of the time people say, okay, so then what is the thing that makes you good for it? You know, mm-hmm. no curse words, having stems available, having really clean rights, meaning you're not confused on a sample. Like the sample is cleared if there is one. You know exactly who owns what portion of song. You know, there's no nonsense. And then also having like instrumental right. versions and, you know, the stems, like I said. So like just making it as easy as possible for right. the music supervisor to understand what they're getting and that it will be easy for them to work with. That's probably like my best advice to someone who's looking to pursue sync. But beyond, you know, way more important than sync is get your publishing in order.
Right. Good advice. And also for those who maybe don't know, like sync goes beyond just like placements in movies and like commercials, right? There's like video games.
Oh my God,
I don't
yeah.
know if there's other things, but it's right. Yeah. It's huge. Like there's a lot of different opportunities.
Absolutely. And there are like different sizes of payouts. Like, you know, there isn't kind of like a set standard necessarily for like, okay, a video game makes this and a commercial makes that. And so you, mm-hmm. you know, I say that to kind of be aspirational. Like you really don't know like what someone's budget is. Obviously if you're at like Microsoft right. versus like community college, like those budgets are going to look different, but, right. like it can really be life-changing. And you know, just closing one deal. And I think it's really important to be aware of, like you said, it's not just TV shows. It's not just movies. Gaming has dwarfed the music industry, the TV industry, like all of that shit. I think I heard a stat at a conference once that was like gaming is economically like inclusive of like music, TV, film, the NFL combined.
Oh my God. That's crazy.
Which is insane.
Makes sense.
And like,
I guess it makes
sense. No, definitely. And like, you know, music, I think, needs to catch up with gaming. Like, gaming has such a chokehold on the entire world. And, you know, for good reason. I think it's a really powerful tool for building community, especially after 4 or 5 years of the COVID stuff and, you know, how the world is different now. And it can be a really, really awesome tool for discovery and the community tools that exist, right? So like your Twitch and, you know, even social media, like, you know, people playing games on there on live and stuff and all of that. Like, it can be a really, really great way for musicians not only to do something they love if they're into gaming. Like T-Pain is a really good example of that. You know, it can be a really great way for them to connect with other creators and get on there and like, you know, build their fans that way and have like this kind of mutual love for something. It doesn't have to be gaming necessarily, but like, you know, something where they're connecting with creators who aren't necessarily musicians. And then like you have more fans that way. And I think that's leading into a different point about how it used to be that you would sell the record and then promote the record. These days you're selling yourself and you're using the record to do that. So like, I think on social media, like for you, earnestly, for someone on the come up to be making money, you have to have your hands in merchandise and you have to have some sort of brand deals going on. You have to have like all of these ancillary things that aren't necessarily music focused to support music and creating music for yourself.
So true. Yeah, that's actually might be an interesting, that's super interesting. Like a hypothetical, let's say someone has a song that's really, that they wrote, that they own, that's really like about mental health or something.
Sure.
What would you say is like the first, like what should they think about in terms of if they really want to reach a lot of audiences? Like what's something to set themselves up with success?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's like brokenrecord.com, be authentic, do the thing that feels right. But like on TikTok, like there's an artist that I absolutely adore. His name is Z Machine. And he on social media just started doing these things to promote his new song where he has, I think what the gay community referred to as maybe a bear. and he is like, you know, laying on like someone's like ass and like singing his song. And it's like funny, it's eye catching, you know, and it's true to him. And, you know, it's true to his music and, you know, all of that. And, but it stands on its own. You know what I mean? So like, it's not, I don't think it's enough for you as a musician to just get on and look at the camera and sing your song. Like show your personality, show people who you are, because they want to be friends with you. They want to support you and then they'll love your music. You know what I mean? So like, and obviously those things happen simultaneously and you know, some ways the reverse, whatever. But like, I think that the best way for you to promote your music is to engage yourself, be vulnerable, show people who you are and share that. And then people will kind of buy in.
Yeah. I love that. It's so true. I think like, people forget that social media is a social platform and like personalities and authenticity is what, you know, makes people interested in you because of like relating to people. And I mean, even when I worked with like Alicia Keys and we had to do some like paid content for her album release, we did like an A/B test of like very commercial kind of like promotional videos that were produced by like a studio, you know, like the Out Now, like kind of like the old like CD commercials. And then we also just like, I was like, but maybe you should literally just like hold the phone, record on like the front facing camera and just like be like, hey, it's Alicia Keys, my album's coming out tomorrow. And like that one did so much better than the overproduced one. Cause like, it just fits the platform more. It feels more organic. And I think that people tend to overthink and think they need like a budget and all this crazy stuff. When it's really just about creativity.
100%. And like, I think a lot of people get, you know, perfection paralysis or whatever and don't try things. Yes. And I think it's really important. And, you know, I'm not a musician, but speaking for myself, just in the way I fucking design my cabinets, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, I'm like, what if I don't get it right? And it's just do something. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. That's okay. You can try something different.
So true.
And for Alicia Keys specifically, and also I think you should, I don't know if you have yet, but you should do a whole ep on working with Alicia Keys. Cause I think that would be really cool.
That's a good idea. I would have a lot to say.
Yeah, I bet. But she's so cool. And, you know, I don't know her either professionally or personally or anything, but, you know, the thing that I remember about her aside from her music is that she doesn't wear makeup. And I think that, having her do a video that is, like you said, organic that way really fits who she is. And, you know, it seems like a perfect kind of fit to stay on that, like, organic, like, no bullshit, no makeup. You know, it's not the same thing as taking it to commercial.
That's such a good point that I didn't even think of with that idea.
No, claim it, Julia. Claim it.
But it's true. Like, she's truly as down to earth as she seems. And that's like awesome. Would literally get on like FaceTime for calls. And like, you're right. Like, it's that's so authentic. Like, why wouldn't you use that to your advantage?
100%.
In a sense. I love that. Well, cool. Okay. So now my first question is, talk about your favorite genre of music and how you got involved in the emo scene. So I feel like I just put you in a box right at the end of that question.
That's okay. I mean, it all kind of, everyone's sad in all of them. So it is the emo genre.
That's so true.
Everyone's depressed. Honestly, I mean, if I can be vulnerable, I think that's always been a struggle for me. I think, you know, my parents got divorced really young. I had kind of a tumultuous upbringing and like finding that energy that sort of made me feel seen and heard. And, you know, regardless of if now I look back and I cringe at the lyrics, but I remember having this sort of come to Jesus moment. I think I was probably like 10 and realizing that like, oh, other people, you know, you're 10 years old, to grind us all, like other people feel this way. Other people can verbalize how they're feeling. Like, that's really cool. It's something that I want to like put my whole heart and soul into. And I think I wanted to be a musician. I really wanted to go on tour. And, you know, I just all day, all night, you know, I'd be like on the computer, like looking up bands and like trying to find out everything I could about them. And I loved Blink-182 growing up. It was like one of my first records. Like, my dad got me fully by accident. It's actually kind of a funny story. Like, my dad worked at Westchester County Airport. Shout out Westchester. For like,
no way. I didn't know.
Yeah, he was the terminal manager there or something for like 30 years. And somebody, I guess, left a like album of CDs behind. And, you know, they have some threshold of like, I don't know, 30 days or something for somebody to claim something, and they didn't. And I think my dad saw that I was so interested in music and stuff. And it was, you know, it was a lot of like Britney Spears and Linkin Park and Pink and like all of these, you know, topical things at the time. What was it, the year probably 2000 or something? And I was like a duck to water with Dude Ranch. I loved that record so much. I still do. And Blink-182 to today is still one of my absolute favorite bands. But anyway, so like,
I love that.
I used to literally them and like Fall Out Boy when I got into like 6th, 7th grade.
Yes. Oh my God. It was such a 7th grade. Yep.
And like, I would go to all the signings, and I remember I brought one of my friends.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like, I brought one of my friends with me to a show, and she wasn't as into it as I was. And I printed out pages, Julia, pages of information on the band, like how tall Pete Wentz was, all of the lyrics, everything, photos. I put this shit,
iconic,
put this shit in a binder, gave it to her a week before. I was like, study, bitch.
Stop.
Swear to God.
Oh my God. You were just like born to be, yeah, in the industry you are. I'm obsessed with that.
It's so whack and lame, but like, I was passionate. It's fine.
I don't think it's lame at all. I think that's like so fucking cool.
Yeah. It'd be like a funny scene for someone to write, like for a 6th grader, you know? Yeah. But yeah, so I started out like, I think just really authentically like into it, and I wanted to be a part of it. And I tried to play music and I sucked at it. And I was like, all right, well, if I can't play anything, I'm going to learn everything I can about this business. And I'm going to do everything I possibly can to support artists the way that I feel like they've supported me. And that is something that I still really feel now. And like, when I have hard days and work is bullshit and somebody says something to me and I don't like it, I really try to come back to that and remember why I'm doing this. And it helps a lot.
I love that. I've never thought about it that way of like paying them back for something. Like, that's such a beautiful sentiment.
Thanks.
And like,
yeah,
such a good motivator.
Yeah. And
it's so sweet.
I do feel like, you know, when I got the gig at TuneCore initially, like one of the things that really drew me to the company was that, like, I really aligned with that value of, like, we need to do everything we can to bolster independent artists. So, you know, it felt like a natural fit. But yeah, I mean, like, just, you know, personally, I think that was kind of my start with it. And then, like, as I got older, I got into, like, some of the more hardcore stuff. Like, Every Time I Die, I'm literally wearing an Every Time I Die sweatshirt right now. It's still one of my absolute favorite bands. RIP, they broke up a couple years ago. But, like, the more metal, like, harder vocals, like, that kind of stuff, I really gravitated to, like, later, like, in high school. And then now, I still love it all. Like, I went to go see Idols on Tuesday night. Nice. Here. I'm obsessed. They're so fucking good. But I fucking love Espresso. I can't stop listening to it. It's a Sabrina Carpenter song.
Oh my gosh. I'm so glad you brought that up. That song is literally in my head 24/7.
It's so fucking good. Also, I was having dinner with a couple girlfriends the other day, and they were like, I can't stop hearing it, like Mario, like when she says it. It's a me, Espresso.
Oh my God, I'm dead. I'm never
going to
hear it the same.
It's a funny.
I saw one.
Yeah.
I saw a meme today that was like, I'm depressed, and someone, it was like a text, and then the other person said, it's me, Depresso.
Straight up.
So it really just fits so much. Yeah. That's amazing. That song really, like, I just am blown away by, like, the pop, female pop movement right now, because so many, like, it's unique. I feel like every pop singer has a different style, but it's so, like, radio friendly.
So yeah,
I'm usually not into that, but, like, oh my God, everything's hitting for me.
Me too. I know you're a duo girl, and that album is great.
I know, it's so good. It's like, I imagine there's so much pressure after, like, a sophomore album that did so well to, like, do well, but so I'm kind of accepted it's not gonna be, like, her biggest, but I think that almost makes it better.
Yeah,
like, less pressure.
And I think, like, the lyrical quality is great, and it's like a chiller vibe. But, like, I think the songs are great songs.
Back to the more of the emo side. I was also going to say, like, I think for our generation as being millennials, like, we're known as the depressed realist kind of generation. So it, like, makes sense to me that, like, we grew up with that type of music, because it was just, like, that's how it's what you're saying. It was such a reflection of, like, the angst that we felt. And I think, like, we still relate to that inner angst that we all had.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think that, like, you know, people like to, like, assign that to, like, emo music or, like, post-hardcore or pop punk, whatever it is. Right. Those sentiments exist in every genre. Country is the first emo.
True.
Blues, it's literally called blues.
So true. So true.
You know, it's a universal human thing. And I think that, like, it kind of became our personality, for lack of a better term, but it does, it does exist for everyone. And I think that, like, that kind of universality of it, like, if you look at it from that perspective, like, brings everybody a little bit more on the same page.
For sure. And I mean, the fact that it's making such a comeback, and, like,
that's wild to me.
Like, cool again. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah, what's your take on it?
I think that there's some cool stuff. Well, I'll start with the musical element, and then I'll come to the cultural element. Like, I think that the music that's coming out is a little different, but, like, I think that, like, some of it comes across a little bit gimmicky to me. And I think you could say that, you know, you can make that argument about the music back then too, but maybe it's because I'm older. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just like, right. It's not resonating the same way. Whereas I feel bad saying this, but I feel like there was maybe some more substance for the things that I was exposed to younger. Someone's gonna hear this and be like, she's talking about Blink-182, the fuck. But
no, but that's fair. That's totally fair.
There is some cool stuff. Like, I love I think Bad Omens is doing a really good job. They're kind of, you know, newer, and, like, they're on rock radio, which, you know, is always kind of interesting for me to hear, like, the emo stuff being on rock radio again, as opposed to, like, right there with, like, Dave Grohl and, you know,
right.
But yeah, no, I think culturally speaking, like, the idea that, like, the when we were young, you know, coming up, and, like, yeah, all this stuff, like, I've heard that there's talks of, like, them bringing back Warped Tour, not from a professional standpoint, just anecdotally on social media. Like, I've seen people talk about it.
Yeah.
And all of that honestly like puts me right back to being 16 and be like, you guys are fucking posers. You weren't there. You didn't like it. Stop acting like you were an emo kid because you heard one all-time low song on the radio in Ohio in 2010. I'm over it. That's me being a hater, but also me being, you know, if I could put that in a box, I'm really excited that, like, you know, Avril Lavigne is going on a greatest hits tour and, like, you know, the music itself is still stands and people still love it. And, like, newer, you know, kids who are growing up are hearing it and being like, that fucking rips. Like, that's cool. You know what I mean? So I'm here for that.
It is so crazy. I just saw Avril Lavigne was on Call Her Daddy. And I was like, if you told like 13 or 14, whatever year old me that Avril Lavigne is in the biggest podcast on an interview in 2024, I would never believe it. Die. Like that. It does speak to so much of like, yeah, how much it still resonates.
100%.
I think it's cool. Like the whole like, yeah, but I think, I guess because it's also been like around 20 years since that was like peak.
Don't say that out loud, music. Julia.
I know, but it's a good excuse for all these bands to get back together, which is awesome.
100%.
Like, that's the nice thing. And like that I like, and I think that that's cool that now like different generations are all connecting on that. But I do agree with you, like the new bands I think are missing whatever it was that the OGs had. Like it just doesn't hit the same.
Yeah And I get like I think there are some people who are doing it really well. Like I think Youngblood is crushing.
I really like Youngblood.
Yeah, and like, but at the same time I've seen him do a lot of personality content and I don't know that I would feel that way if I didn't feel like he was a good kid, you know what I mean?
Yeah, to your point, like I think about how genres like all have that kind of like sad whatever emotional component. Like so many hip-hop artists of like Gen Z, their biggest influences are like pop punk bands.
Yeah,
and I'm like always so blown away by that. Like I remember
Juice WRLD.
Yes. Yeah. He loved Fall Out Boy. Like he always, and like I think Blink-182. It's just so interesting.
Yeah,
and really cool to see.
Definitely. And him, it's funny you brought him up because I was also gonna say God rest his soul, but his estate got sued by Yellow Card.
Really?
Yeah, because he has like a bit of a riff from a Yellow Card song in one of his songs.
Whoa.
I don't know where that left off in court, but this is a publishing issue. This is like,
yeah,
you'd call that an interpolation. So he used the composition within the song, but not the recording of the song. You know, he recorded his own version, I guess, but it's not a cover. It's part of his new work.
Ooh, yeah. Can you talk about interpolation? I'm obsessed with interpolation. I need an interpolation playlist, but I want you to explain
it. I want to hear that. I really want to hear that.
I'll send it to you. Yeah.
Yeah. So like an interpolation and a sample is like the two things that kind of like go together in that conversation. So a sample is when someone uses a recording of an existing song within their new song. Hip hop is a sample genre. Like there's a ton of sampling that happens in hip hop, but also, you know, elsewhere. And the important distinction there is like sample is the use of the recording, whereas an interpolation is just the use of the composition. So as I was saying with the Juice WRLD song, let me find it actually, because you know it's nice to have an example to actually go ahead and listen to. An interpolation is just the use of the composition within the new song. Sometimes that can, you know, it becomes a derivative, like you'll hear that word tossed around of an original work. Gets, you know, there's certain rights associated with that and stuff. I'm not going to talk about that eloquently. You can go look it up. But
yeah, fair.
the important distinction there is that one is the sound recording, one is just the composition. And for you to be able to license that material, you have to, you know, procure like a license agreement from the original owner or the original publisher of that content. So in the Juice WRLD situation, Lucid Dreams is the Juice WRLD song.
Yeah, that was like his big hit.
Yeah, and so the accusation is that they basically copied Hollywood Died, which is Yellow Card's song. And if you listen to the two songs, you can kind of hear a similarity, but I think from the court perspective, if you are going to bring a copyright suit against someone for something like this, the sort of standard is like the average person in the public has to be able to discern the difference. So it's not going to be me who's like been printing out lyrics since I was in sixth grade. It's, you know, it's going to be an average person. So I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to say, you know, sitting where I am, but it'd be interesting for your listeners to go ahead and check out those two songs and see what they think.
Yeah, definitely. I love like, Most of the interpolation tracks that I put together were from like just hearing things. Like I think I'm looking through it right now. Like a really obvious one would be like the Seven Rings by Ariana Grande. And she did like My Favorite Things from The Sound of Music.
Right.
But like there's ones I added that like are just known, but then there are ones that like in my head I would hear. So it is a really fun thing to kind of like pick up on. And like, I mean, there's so much music in the world. Like, of course, some things are going to sound like other things. It's a really interesting, somewhat like controversial topic, I feel like.
Yeah. What are there, like 9 notes in a scale? Come on, guys.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's like music has been around forever. And like, yeah, it's inevitable that people are. And I think that like, it's okay. Like inspiration is part of it. Right?
Absolutely. So, like, yeah.
It's a really interesting topic. Like we could do a whole episode about that.
100%. And like the AI part of that conversation. Very interesting.
Yeah.
It's obviously like going to open a whole can of worms. Like there's opportunity there for there to be a whole lot of rights issues. Aside from the obvious being that like AI is not a songwriter. You can't claim royalties off of something you didn't write.
It's interesting how, I mean, it's obviously such a hot topic right now. Even at like South by Southwest, we were both down there. And
girl.
Like, it's like you couldn't escape it.
You can't turn a corner without somebody being like, machine learning is so annoying.
I know. I was like, oh my God. Like, I guess it will die down, but like, obviously, it's here to stay. So, back to music. I'm curious also, you mentioned like the music festival scene. And
yeah.
Can you talk about like growing up and going to festivals? Because I was never allowed to go.
I'm sorry to hear that. yeah, no, I was really lucky in that my parents were not necessarily interested. My mom, I think, came to one Warped Tour when I was like little, cause I started going to shows when I was like 9 or 10. Like it was the only thing I wanted to do. And,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. So my mom and my dad were really big music people, differently, but I think my mom kind of saw this light in me and wanted to nurture it. So she was really supportive. And, I also had a friend growing up, her name was Marlo. Shout out Marlo. Her dad would bring us to a lot of stuff, and you know, my parents worked crazy hours and you know, they weren't really available in the same way. He would literally bring us to shows, stay with us the whole time. He'd come and stay at Warped Tour all day long, like a poor man, but I do think he enjoyed it. So, you know, we started going really young, and also, growing up in New York, we had New Jersey so close by. There was a festival there called Bamboozle Festival, which was, I lived yes, for that shit. It was so good. And, you know, he would just come with us and we would go crazy. And I think it really helped having a friend who also loved it the way that I did. It was really nice to have someone who I could, you know, be as excited as I was and like have someone respond with the same energy. And I think that really helped me keep going. Cause I don't think I missed a Warped Tour except for once from when I started going to when they stopped doing it. So like, I love that shit. But at the same time, like, you know, I think it's like two separate things in my mind when you talk about music festivals and Warped Tour. it was a fucking shit show. Crazy.
That's why I wasn't allowed to go. I know my mom is listening right now and I am just, yeah. I mean, I always like was so, I mean, especially being that angsty age, I was like, oh, I want to go to New Jersey. I want to go to Bamboozle. And like all the cool people got to go and I never did. But I also, in retrospect, I was like, there's a reason why they stopped.
No, and you're absolutely right. And as a parent now, I'm very, very thankful, like I said, for Marlo's dad, Pete, for taking us. Yeah. Because I remember, this is funny, I haven't thought about this in so long, but there was like this group of girls and they were like the cool kids. They would like get drunk and do drugs and, you know, they were sick and they were all skinny and pretty. And they all like lied to their parents and went. And I remember being like, oh my God, like I was scared for their lives. Like I was like, they're going to get so much fucking trouble. And
you were the cool one because you had a cool parent with you.
I guess at the time that didn't feel cool, but like, yes, that's absolutely true. No,
definitely not. And like, yeah, for those who don't really know, it was like literally in like the parking lot of a stadium, right?
Yeah, always in a parking lot. The last one that they did was on the beach in New Jersey at Atlantic City. So that was really cool. Logistically kind of a nightmare to get from one end to the other because walking in sand just takes forever. But no, but it was, yeah, historically on concrete in like 95 degree weather on the East Coast, which is super humid in the summer. So you'd see kids like passing out left and right. Yeah. Like water was like $5 and it was only a $40 ticket to get in. So, like, riddle me that one.
Oh, my God. I didn't realize it was that cheap. I guess it makes sense given the demographic.
Yeah. And it got more expensive, certainly. But it was, I remember it being super cheap. And I remember, like, it would be where I did all my shopping for school. Because I got all my band t-shirts. Like, they would have, like, other fashion companies, like, in that scene. It felt so, like, representative of who I was, and I felt so edgy and cool because my whole wardrobe came from Warped Tour, so I, like, saved up all my money and, like, would carry a backpack around with shit, like, to take home. But I mean, the reason I brought that up is because I remember, like, they would sell sneakers because it was the Vans Warped Tour, and I remember, like, racing to try to get, like, the, like, limited edition sneakers that they would do for the tour because they would sell out really fast.
Whoa, that's really sick.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So you have like a whole collection.
I did. They're gone now.
Oh, sad.
I wish I had the wherewithal at the time to be like, you're going to love this shit when you're in your
30s. Yeah. What were some of like the best bands or like at the time your favorite bands that you got to see there?
That's a great question. So I feel like they do kind of book the same bands over and over again, which I love. I feel like I've seen them like 40 times, but I saw when Fall Out Boy was on hiatus, Pete Wentz had a side project called the Black Cards with none other than Bebe Rexha, who is now...
No way!
Yeah. So I saw them perform.
I didn't know that.
And that was, it was really, really cool. And I remember going up to her and being like, it's so cool that you get to be in a band with Pete Wentz.
That's so funny. Oh my God.
Yeah. And like, I got to, you know, talk to them a little bit because, you know, if without the Fall Out Boy cloud, he's just a guy and they're just people and they just, you know, were at the tent like anyone else. And that was really, really cool. I think, you know, some other bands like Coheed and Cambria is one of my favorites to this day. Like seeing them perform, it was amazing. Like I remember being really taken aback by their stage presence, and obviously their music speaks for itself. Also like to add the funny outliers that would appear at these shows. Snoop Dogg played one year. So that was pretty cool. And then like Lil Wayne, I remember seeing either open for A Day to Remember or vice versa, which was a wild.
But there's that connection, the hip hop connection again, I guess.
Yeah. And you would see that consistently, like, with Khalifa, Snoop Dogg and Lil Wayne is a skater. So I think that there's that also,
right,
you know?
Right.
But yeah, so there's a whole lot of like bands like that. Also, like, I don't know if you remember this one, but Family Force 5 or like, oh my God, what's that band? Like For Sure Maybe, For Sure Not, the Medic Droid.
I was obsessed with that song. I still listen to it like maybe once or twice a year. There was this guy, my freshman year of high school, this guy moved to our town and he was from Canada and he was like I had the biggest crush on him. Like I was so delusional. Like I didn't even speak to him and I had this whole narrative of like what he was like, but he would post on his Facebook like music videos of that genre and that's how I got into it. And he loved that song and he loved, so I listened to it all the time thinking it was like deep. I listened to the band Cartel like all the time. I still love them to this day.
Same.
Yeah. And like, but oh my God, you just brought me back to that. Like my sister said she was afraid of me during that era. So.
If I had a sister, she definitely would have been afraid of me too. Don't worry.
These bands are very male oriented and like fandom is very male oriented. So what was it like being a young female in the space? And like to this day, I guess.
Yeah. In my own experience, it's kind of interesting because I like never really thought of myself as like, I'm a girl and that makes me different. Like coming up in that scene, like I was just like, I'm here because I love this music. You know, I'd go up to people and want to start conversations. And I think that can be perceived as flirting or, you know, these conversations that you have that you hear about, like the emo band guys, like grooming underage girls, like that is very real. And I don't mean to discredit that, but I think like when I was 16, I was like, yeah, I would love for, you know, one of them to like hit on me. You know what I mean? But you're a child and you don't know any better. And it's just like something you see in the movies, which again, this is this narrative that's perpetuated by Hollywood and mainstream media and, you know, in the US specifically. And it's a massive problem, but I think it's one that, again, like I'll credit Gen Z and, you know, maybe a little bit us, but like, there is just this like less tolerance for it. And I think that while it still is a problem, a lot of the conversations you hear from men, or the comments you hear from men are self-aware and, you know, wanting to learn At least, you know, I'm speaking from my own experience, but like, you know, people will be inappropriate. Like that is a reality. But I think that I've been lucky enough to have really, really great examples of what it looks like to be respectful and be respected.
That's really interesting and like completely fair. And I actually, one of the other interviews I did with the founder of Amplify Her Voice, Christina, like she said the exact same thing that like, she would be at shows and like completely not even thinking about gender and like just being like, I'm just there because I deserve to be here just as much as anyone else. And like, there's just no distinction. And it sucks that like society makes that distinction for us because otherwise it would be an anonymous issue.
100%.
It is important to talk about just so that like maybe it will, yeah, make more people in that those positions aware of like how they can make it a little more equal or just harmonious.
Yeah. And I think there are like companies and organizations who are like deliberately trying to kind of fix this cultural issue, which is really cool. Like I saw a panel a couple of years back at South By with Safe Tour, which is, I can't remember her name, but she used to manage, or she does manage like a country artist. It's pretty big. And another one is Calling All Crows, which is, yes, yeah. So I saw Nikki, I think is their name from Calling All Crows, speak about it and talk about like what it looks like to educate venue staff and, you know, tour staff about like what to look for and, you know, how to make sure that everybody feels safe in the environment, especially when, you know, listening to stuff that I listen to, there are things like mosh pits and walls of death and, you know, opportunities for, you know, even crowd surfing. Like I remember once, I've never talked about this, I think ever. One time I was crowd surfing because I really loved to do that when I was a kid. And like some kid like put his fingers in my shorts. You know what I mean? And like, it happened. Yeah. I don't feel devastated. Like it was just like, yeah. I was like, oh, that sucked. Like whatever. But looking out for that kind of shit and calling it out when it happens. I didn't say a word. You know what I mean? So I think it happens, like things happen in venues, at shows, whatever, all the time. But at the same time, I think even, you know, more recently, I've seen people call out bad behavior and like get bouncers to be like, get this guy the fuck out of here.
Right, right.
Actually, that reminds me of a funny story. Once I was at an emo night. Anyway, I was at a show once and I saw this guy shove the shit out of a girl. This is at Irving Plaza in New York. And I don't know what came over me, but I just like got in his face. And I was like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, you know what I mean? Like just causing a scene. She came up and she was like, no, it's all good. We're friends. Like he was just joking around, like earnestly. Like it wasn't like an unsafe situation, but she was like, thank you so much for like speaking up for me. I would love to see more of that. Like, you know what I mean? Like that kind of conversation. And we all like hugged it out. Like, you know what I mean? So like, I think, like it's happening, like as much as the shitty stuff is happening, good stuff's happening too. And it's moving in the right direction, I think.
Right. That's really nice to hear. And like, yeah, at the end of the day, like it should be a community among everyone. So like, for sure. And I think I love those organizations that are putting more accountability on the venues and like the people who work within the venues. Cause that's really who should and can be the ones to step in. So I love that. Well, a couple like wrap up questions. I was curious to ask, because I know you're obviously from New York and you love LA. In terms of music scene, like, can you talk a little bit about New York versus LA?
First of all, New York till I die. I love LA, but like, there is nothing like New York. It is the greatest city in the world. But musically, I think the scenes are very different and the approach to music is very different. I think that the aesthetic and the foray into other aspects of entertainment is really ever present here in a way that it's not in New York. Growing up in New York, in the hardcore scene, in, you know, seeing people put together house shows and all that, it's not something I can speak to in LA. I'm sure it happens, but I don't think it's going to happen as well as New York. Sorry.
Yeah, I think like there's obviously truth to like, if you want to work in music, LA or New York are like the places to be. But I do think that there's opportunities in other places. Like I just interviewed someone who works for like touring management. So she literally goes to cities like all the time and like just helps a lot, like open different venues. Cool. But I'm always curious to hear like Yeah, which for as someone who now has experienced both, what you like, because I know you do love
Bella. I do. It's so nice here.
Yeah. Okay. So my final couple of questions, this kind of puts you on the spot, but if you were to have your own Warped Tour revival, who would be like the top
three? Oh, Julia, that's so hard.
I know. It's. I feel like it's unfair.
See, okay. I'm going to explain my reasoning before I answer, because I could go a couple different ways. One is like all-time greats that I've seen before, and like, you know, I'm not picking them because I want to see them for the first time, or I could do like bands I haven't gotten this to see, or, you know, haven't seen that often, or, you know, whatever. Figure it out, Alyssa. Microwaves. I love Microwaves. Ooh. Yeah, I think I'm going lesser known, less popular, less like I'm kind of like riffing on your question. I'm not directly answering it. I saw a band play at South By this year that I loved called the Manatees. They're out of the UK.
Oh, so many good bands at South By.
Microwave, what I say, the Manatees, and then maybe, speaking of Every Time I Die, their side, like the bands that evolved from them. Better Lovers is like a Every Time I Die, Dillinger Escape Plan, like super group, I guess, if you could call it that. I don't know. Do two bands make a super group?
Ooh, fun. Yeah, I guess so. I like it. I'm not that I know. I like the names. Microwaves and Manatees. It's all has like a nice ring.
Yeah, those are all over the shop, as it were. But they're all good ones.
Awesome. And then my final question I like to ask everyone, if you had to give your music career an album title so far, what would it be?
An album title? My music career? Oh my God. keeps getting better.
Love it.
Yeah. I mean that.
That's so sweet. And like, I believe it. Even from where I've seen, like where we work together, it does keep getting better. And I'm really proud of you. It's awesome.
I'm proud of you. Look at us. Who'd have thought?
Look at us. Yeah, I love that about music. Like, it really does bring people together, as corny as it is.
It does.
Well, awesome. Thank you so, so much. This was, like, so fun, and I learned so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just, like, really appreciative of your time.
Of course. Thank you for having me. It's been really, really fun.